welcome to Writer's Blockbusters, the show where we treat the final edit of the movie like the script. I'm one of your hosts, Bob Rose, at Thundergrunt Bob on all the relevant social medias. And right now, Jimmy's going to introduce himself.
I am Jimmy George. I am a screenwriter and script consultant, and my Twitter handle is at Jimmy R. George.
And now, Jamie.
I am Jamie Nash. I am a screenwriter, and I am the writer of the Save the Cat Rights for TV book and also the Save the Cat Beat Sheet workbook. I am on Twitter at Jamie_Nash.
All right. Now that you know our Twitter handles, we can move on. We haven't recorded for like a month. So sorry if we're all rusty, it's the scheduling thing. We are here to talk about, I think, you know, a movie that it's kind of surprising we haven't tackled in almost 7 years, right? Mm-hmm. But then again, we don't do many sequels. It takes this really special sequel for us to all agree to actually do it. So we're going to talk about Aliens today from 86, right? That's it's 1986. Mm-hmm. Before we get into our discussion topics, let's go around and just say what this movie means to each of us. Let's start with Jimmy.
I was 6 years old when this came out, so I did not see it. I was a little late to it, you know, teenager. I love this movie. I think it's one of the best. I've listened to the James Horner score more than any other film score, that Bishop's Countdown that's in all the trailers. I really cannot wait for the day when I find a revival screening where I can see this on the big screen, because I've never seen it on the big screen and I really want to see it. So that's my big take.
Nice. Jamie.
So this one is a really big one for me. I saw this when I was 14 in the theater. I think if you go back to the Alien podcast, I talked about how I got the Alien illustrated story as a real little kid, like maybe 6 years old or seven or something like that. And I read it so many times. I was like fascinated by it, but I never saw the movie. I was always like too scared to see the movie, even till I was 14. Also, it wasn't on, I didn't have cable. I used to watch a lot of stuff on like UHF and stuff like that. Like that's where I saw most of my horror movies. I probably got cable by the time I was 14, but it took a while. We were like the last ones to get cable and HBO and stuff. So I had never seen Alien, but I knew the whole story. So when Aliens came out, I was a movie geek already. And I went to Westview Cinema. It was, remember, old Westview for the Baltimore, Catonsville folks.
Woo!
My favorite cinema. And
dating
it was
yourself
a
bit there.
Yeah, it was my favorite. It was where I saw all the movies. I saw Raiders of the Lost Ark there. I saw everything.
Yeah.
It was in the big theater. And it was the first movie, I think, in Dolby, I think, that was there, right? Mm. I'd never heard surround sound before, or whatever it was at the time. And it was the most intense movie watching experience of my life. And I can't really remember any movie. It was the peak intense movie watching experience of my life. I can remember where I sat. I remember how intense it was. I can remember how it was intense, but fun. It wasn't like intense, but like I couldn't watch or needed to leave or throw up or something. It was fun. It was like the best roller coaster I'd ever seen. And I always put it as the best pure movie watching experience I ever had was seeing Aliens. You know, it's R rated. I think me and my friends, they didn't care back then. We were 14. We got in. Nobody paid any attention. My father wasn't going to go watch a sci-fi movie. He didn't care about that shit. So it was just a bunch of kids sitting in like the sixth row in a packed theater on opening night watching Aliens. And there was no better experience. It was my number one movie watching in theater experience of all time is Aliens.
Damn, it's like created half your DNA there, Jamie.
Yeah, it was awesome.
Yeah, I feel like my story is a little bit similar to Jimmy is in just that I didn't get to see it in the theater. I'm too young for having that. And for me, but I'll say this, for me, Aliens for the longest time was the Alien franchise. Like, you know what I mean? As a kid, this was the one that was on. I actually did have cable. I'm a spoiled brat. Like this was the one that was on television. This was the one that I associated with the whole franchise. It defined everything that was Aliens. Not until I got older did I kind of identify with Aliens. I sort of watched the sequels and everything, but everything encompassing the pop culture of this franchise was this movie. So, you know, obviously I love it. And the last thing I'll say is I recently learned by going through some old stuff that I own 5 copies of this on VHS, and one of them still wrapped. And the other one is signed by Lance Henriksen. So, yeah,
great.
I have many copies of Aliens on VHS. I don't know. Does that count as fandom? Sure. But an unopened copy of Aliens on VHS, still with the wrap on it.
We'll add it to the garage sale list.
Yeah. If you're interested in buying
the course of this show.
Yeah. If you want to buy Jamie's Ninja Turtles comic, and you're really interested in a wrapped Aliens VHS, we got you. Our eventual yard sale is going to be really great. Okay. So, Jamie, who wrote this shit?
Who wrote this shit? It's funny. I don't have that open. Because now I'm debating. Did anybody get a credit besides James Cameron?
I think
Walter Hill was on there.
Walter Hill, Dan Giler.
But did they get a real credit, or did they get
story
a based on character?
They got a story by. Screenplay is only James Cameron.
That's what I couldn't remember. Because I do know the history of this. I know that they came up with the soldiers in space kind of concept from a high level. I think they had been developing it. I had this book by Rinsler recently. There's a guy named Rinsler who I'm always promoting his books. He does these making, I think he died. That might've been his last book. But he did an Aliens book a couple years back and I couldn't find it. I was going to reread the development chapter, but there might've even been some development that surprised me a little bit before James Cameron. There might've been, I can't remember. I'd have to dig up the book. But James Cameron ultimately came in and did a treatment. And I'm sure he did one of his scriptments was what it was. I'm sure I did. I can't really remember. I wish I had the book, but I'm sure it was one. So James Cameron was known for doing these like 100-page scriptments. And they're like the famous one that's out there. There's a Spider-Man one out there that you can see. It's like longer than my screenplays, but it's his treatment, right? I don't quite understand it. Like when he writes the script, it gets shorter than his treatment. I still don't really, I can't wrap my head around it really. No,
it works apparently.
It works, but it was his thing. And he would always say he did a scriptment, which was kind of like he'd take his treatment and then he'd put like interior, exterior in it, kind of like TV outlines do, but then he'd kind of just write it. So I don't know why it wasn't just a script without dialogue. It was, I don't know. He even writes dialogue. I don't know.
Some of the dialogue's in there.
It's really strange. It's almost like it's a first draft, but he just kind of gives it this weird, like, hey, I might skip over some stuff. So just bear with me. But he did that. And then I think he had to go off and make Terminator. And I think he did the scriptment. It went through some different studio execs. Like some people wanted to make it, some people didn't, things like that. Somebody finally picked up a scriptment and was like, hey, this is great. He started to write it. Then he had to go do Terminator, but they liked it so much. They were like, we're going to wait. When you get back from doing Terminator, we want you to come and write the script. And at that time, he kind of pitched like, I'd like to direct it as well. And I think they gave him a maybe. They were like, yeah, we'll see
how Terminator turned out.
They wanted to see how Terminator turned out. And of course, Terminator turned out cool. And he was also doing like, he did Rambo. He wrote like with Sylvester Stallone to do the second, you know, Rambo. Does Rambo, it's just Rambo, right? First Blood and then Rambo.
Rambo First Blood Part 2.
Okay.
Yeah.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah, that's the title, right? Yeah.
I was like, I always just call it Rambo, but it's kind of like a New Hope to me. It's like they couldn't, they were like, people will be too stupid to realize as if that movie even needed to be a sequel. Like, did anybody see the First Blood and be like, I got to go see the sequel to this to see where the character goes. It was, I don't know. We should do Rambo one day too. Another great movie.
I mean,
going
First Blood's a great movie. Yeah,
it is. It's a great movie, but it's weird as far as a sequel goes.
It's a genre change almost.
It's a genre change for sure. So anyway, that's kind of the development story. And then, you know, Terminator happened. He got this gig. He went off to the UK. Everybody hated him. You know, all that stuff happened. So they didn't they try to poison him or something on the set? Or there's some weird.
Oh my god!
There's some weird story. Conjecture though. I don't know if it's proven.
Yeah, like somebody like poisoned the catering or something, so he'd get like really sick. Or something.
Jamie, I thought you were gonna give the famous anecdote with the whiteboard,
the dollar sign,
yeah,
the aliens. Times. Yeah, and I think he's confirmed that. So apparently, the weird thing is, I don't know when he did that because they already had the soldier version. Wouldn't they have had aliens? I don't know.
There was only one that they were fighting. Maybe they were.
Yeah. So apparently he went in and wrote alien and then put a dollar sign on the end, and it's aliens with the dollar sign.
There's the pitch.
Yeah, no. And then they bought it. They bought it in the room. They were like, oh, dollar sign. I get it. It's going to make lots of money because it has an S and a dollar sign. I don't know. But that's kind of the famous story. He's kind of confirmed that story in recent years too. Like that really happened. So,
not the poisoning thing though, right? I always thought that was.
I think the poisoning thing is kind of like there is some truth to it. I don't know. I've heard some stuff. I mean, when I say poisoning, it was like laxatives or something. You know, it wasn't like they put cyanide in his jelly beans or something like that. I don't know why I picked jelly beans.
It's like they got jelly beans on their crafty.
Yeah.
I think in the UK it would be what was Doctor Who always eating? Jelly bellies or something like that? They were like gummy bears. I don't know.
I actually don't know the answer to that. So wait, okay. The answer to who wrote this shit, we're just going with basically James Cameron, right? Like we're saying. And yeah, then the story by has several credits.
It's Walter Hill, David Giler. Yeah. And that's and James Cameron gets story by.
Gotcha.
Yep.
I just want to make sure it was clear that we're answering that. The first thing we're going to talk about is double bump catalyst, something we've discussed how many times now?
Yeah, a few times, but I always like, this is mine, but it's basically going to be me asking Jamie to do all the talking.
Perfect.
That's why I put this up here. When I'm working with writers a lot, at the front end of their ideas, they get caught up in the inciting incident and the catalyst and what that is and they often will sort of get trapped thinking that there can only be one. And so their entire, you know, brainstorming process comes to a halt because they're like, I need more than one, but I don't feel like I can do that. I'm allowed to do that. So that's why I like bringing up examples where here we watch like a famous movie. And in my opinion, there are two catalysts in order for the story to happen. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, Jamie, would you mind introducing it and going through yours, and then we can talk about aliens and how it relates to this list you have?
Yeah, yeah. So, you know, do you mean introduce double bump catalyst? You kind of did.
Yeah, a little bit. Yeah.
Double bump catalyst. So a catalyst is the first moment where kind of the hero gets some out of the blue, something happened to them that kind of kicks the story off, that takes them from their ordinary world into the upside down world. So, you know, when Neo is working his day job being a hacker, it's when somebody comes to him and says the Matrix is real or whatever, or something like that, or the bad guys are here.
Has you.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But it's something out of the blue that happens. That kind of is the first thing to really kick us into the story, and then ultimately will lead to the upside down world. So I came up with a list of, and a double bump catalyst is when it takes like two things. Two kind of events that kind of have to push them towards that upside down world. So it's more than one.
And when we did 10 things I hate about you, we found three catalysts that were all on this list that you're going to do. And all three needed to happen in order for the story to kick into gear.
And I have a rule that as long as you have one, you're okay. If you have five or 10, that's okay too, as long as they make sense. Like then it just becomes a logic point. Like, are you doing them to do them? Or like there's some degree of randomness that can happen that could be bad. Like if you had somebody get bit by a radioactive spider and then they got struck by lightning and then they won the lottery, it would be like, what's going on? But as long as it kind of makes sense, then I think you're okay to do two, three, four, whatever. They're just events that are happening in your story at that point.
Yeah.
By the way, this is something I feel about almost all the beats. A thing I've come up with for horror movies is what I call the fake beat, because everybody knows Save the Cat, or they've internalized it, or and keep in mind, when I say they know Save the Cat, Save the Cat just codifies storytelling. So you know storytelling. You know, you've been watching movies, you've been reading. So I noticed some horror movies give you a fake All Is Lost, because they're going to hit you with a really wild All Is Lost like 2 seconds later. So they have multiple All Is Lost, or they might have multiple midpoints or something like that. It's all good, as long as you have one. That's my thing. Just make sure you have one. It comes relatively in the right spot. If you don't have any, that's when you're sometimes in trouble. Like, there's no real surprise if, like, we didn't do a surprise twist. Surprise! It's like, no, it doesn't really work that way. So
was,
anyway.
Was it Crystal Skull where we had the catalyst problem? I think that's where we talked about a catalyst
problem. I mean, we had a lot of problems.
We had a lot of problems with that, but I remember specifically us talking about the catalyst issue.
That
of why is this propelling forward? Yeah. It didn't even have really one, is what
I'm
saying.
I think what happened was like, it took like five scenes to describe what the catalyst was.
Yeah, it was a catalyst. Well, and it wasn't compelling.
It was like your old colleague was researching something. He's kind of gone missing. Yeah. We don't know. And it was like,
there's no ticking clock.
And then they went to another scene at a restaurant, and they're still talking about this thing, but it's not even clear what they're talking about. And
yeah.
Yeah.
It's almost
I'm just saying, for an example of something that almost doesn't have one.
Yeah. We'll call that the half a bump catalyst.
The half a bump.
That's the 0.5 bump catalyst. 0.5,
yeah.
So here's a list. I'll go through this really quickly. And if you notice one from Aliens or something, maybe we could talk about it. So these are some common catalysts. In horror movies in particular. So these are ones that, and I kind of categorize Aliens as a horror movie. I know that's debatable. I personally think it's similar to a lot of horror movies. And if you declassify this one just because it takes place in space and it's fun, well, then there's a whole bunch of other ones that have similar beats and similar styles and similar things that you probably also have to declassify that would then be like, what are we even doing here? So, So here are some catalysts for you from horror movies in particular, but they kind of apply to everything. Unleashed horror. So this is where like a monster suddenly attacks, like just out of the blue, it attacks somebody, you know, and it tries to, you know, kill someone or something. And that's the catalyst. So it tries to kill. So Scream is a good example of this one, because Sydney is suddenly attacked, you know, or something that, out of the blue. Bad Moon Rising, it's kind of like the first hint of trouble is on the horizon. You know, there's something like in Deep Impact, like not really a horror movie, but kind of a disaster movie of sorts. We see like a meteor like far away in the distance, mm-hmm. and it's going to destroy the Earth.
It's coming.
So at first news of the bad thing.
There's arguably a little splash of that in Aliens, but in a weird way.
True enough. They're here. It's kind of like the poltergeist of it all. There's some... you know, something shows up for the first time, some supernatural thing, some ghost, something represents itself for the first time. Taken, somebody is kidnapped, there's two versions of these, or somebody gets trapped in a land they can't get out of or something. So Finding Nemo would be one in a non-horror movie. The Wizard of Oz would be this kind, Back to the Future maybe. Toy Story, something like that, or a movie like Taken where somebody's actually kidnapped. So it could be the hero is kind of swept away, or some person is swept away and then they have to find them. Identity crisis, wrongful identity kind of stories like The Fugitive, Minority Report, North by Northwest. Life Sucks. I see now that these particular ones, these are my normal ones, not my horror ones necessarily. So
yeah, I put them all in here because I think
it's all good.
Yeah.
It's all good. I think what I did, I reskinned them for horror, and I was thinking off the top because my head's so focused on that these days that I thought that's that when I saw the Bad Moon Rising and stuff. But it's all good because they're kind of the same. So Life Sucks is a sudden drastic event disrupts the protagonist's world. And this could be anything from like losing your house to something like Up where there's a death or something or divorce or sickness. You shouldn't have seen that. These are characters that see something they shouldn't have seen, like in Rear Window, maybe Fright Night, where they see a vampire killing someone, Enemy of the State, something like that. You're a Wizard or something, which is kind of the Neo one. It's like you have this past, you have this kind of secret past that you're just finding out about for the first time. But also I include History of Violence in that too. It's kind of like the main character knows about the secret.
Jason Bourne even maybe a little bit.
Jason Bourne a little bit as well. Because his ordinary world is kind of that he has no memory. So when he starts to find out he's a spy, it's kind of like...
It's kind of like a superhero, right? Yeah. He has these skills, right?
Absolutely. Maybe, and that's a good pitch. We could do the Jason Bourne with a wizard. That would be, you know? So
just don't shoot it the same. That's all I ask.
We'll have to edit that out of the podcast.
It's a good idea.
The wizard casts a spell. They lose their memory, something, and then they find out I'm a wizard.
Slowly learn they're a wizard. Right. Yeah.
A meet cute would be in a rom com. Two characters meet for the first time as a common catalyst. A big windfall, like a sudden opportunity, winning the lottery, whatever the thing is.
There's kind of one here.
It's kind of one.
There's kind of one, yeah.
And then we've got a job for you, which is more like for James Bond movies or Raiders of the Lost Ark. Like, hey, we know you're an adventurer. We need you to find the Lost Ark. We have a job for you. James Bond, we need you to stop Goldfinger or something like that. So
that would be the 11 significant basic for this, right?
Yeah. So I thought that there was two catalysts and we can debate that. Because I think her getting rescued is a catalyst. Like, that is what sets the whole thing in motion. That's what brings her into this situation. Like, if she doesn't get rescued, the story doesn't happen. So for me, that's just as impactful as like the first shark kill in Jaws, you know? And so I think maybe that could be Life Sucks. Like, she gets taken or taken with a little bit of readjustment, the Taken run, right? They pick her up. That her ordinary world is asleep and safe
for 57 years.
Yeah. Her ordinary world is floating through space, safe from harm, basically. And they pull her into this shit, right? Like, oh, by the way, and it's not in the movie, it's in the director's cut, but oh, by the way, like, everybody you know is dead. Your family's dead. You're in a world that you don't belong. You're a woman out of time. And yeah, life sucks.
Yeah.
So that works. I think this Life Sucks one tracks for me. And then the second one, is your classic catalyst, which is the company loses communication with the colony and they're like, we have a job for you.
So this isn't in the talking points, but I track this a little differently. Like, I don't think necessarily it's a double bump catalyst, but
awesome.
I think it's fine that you say, I'm going to point out the positive of thinking of it that way as the same positive I take from it. So either way you look at it is fine. I kind of view like that to almost be prologue-y kind of material. You know what I mean? It's like, it kind of sets up her ordinary world because it's a sequel. So we kind of have to set her back. But the cool thing about it is, the reason I think it works either way, it sets up that story before the story. And I am always like preaching, what's the story before the story? Because you could just have an ordinary person. It might not be Ripley eating breakfast, you know, hanging out, doing nothing. But instead, it's this fun story before the story where a person wakes up. They find out it's 57 years later. And in the director's cut, they find out their daughter is dead, you know, all this kind of stuff. There's all this interesting intrigue that happens before the we have a job for you. And either way you look at it, it kind of works the same way. So I kind of view it as like a prologue, and then her ordinary world is woman adjusting to coming back to the ordinary world. Which is a story before the story, which could be also a double bump catalog. Either way you look at it.
I just like bringing this up because a lot of people, they get stuck on these quote unquote rules and you know, these things like this thing needs to happen here and it can't happen anywhere else. And that's bullshit, you know, and this is an example of like, here's a movie where you might consider it having two catalysts and it works. It's like one of the best.
Reading the outline too made me think of something I thought of when I was watching the movie for the show. I realized I never really thought of this, but both the first two Jurassic Park sequels are basically worse versions of Aliens.
I never really thought of that,
especially Jurassic Park 3, which is literally almost alien. It's got a child hiding on the island. They got paramilitary guys coming with them, and they got a mission where they have to get a half man who's been there before to come and
yeah, help them out. He's like, Ripley.
Ripley. It's so we've got a job for you. Like, they're just worse versions of aliens. Even though I love those movies, but they're worse versions of aliens.
Yeah.
Yeah. I just realized that while I was watching. I was like, oh, wow. Both those movies are kind of aliens.
and they even put him in situations that parallel the OG T-Rex situation. You know, the OG Jurassic Park situations that he's like, oh, I've been here before exactly like this, only there's more dinosaurs.
The funny thing about it, when I saw this movie when I was 14, this might have been, if I'm thinking about it, the first movie I saw that kind of used this trope in some ways.
Oh, really? Okay.
But it was like 14-year-old Dungeons and Dragons me was using this trope in every adventure I made up, right?
We've got a job for you.
Yeah, it was kind of like, we don't know what happened to the village. We need you to go and figure it out. There's a vampire that lives in the castle above it or whatever. And then they go in and they find out everybody's vampires or zombies or something like that. It's like every story I was DMing back then as a 14-year-old or 13-year-old had this. So when I saw this, I was like, wow, it's just like the stuff. You know, I'd never seen anything. And it mixed horror and adventure and all this stuff. And I was just like, it was part of the reason why it blew me away in some ways.
I mean, we just talked about Rambo, First Blood Part 2. It's literally, we've got a job for that whole movie.
It's true.
Get the old expert, you know, person out, because you're the only one that can actually do this. It's an action movie trope. So many action movies. Wake up the old, you know, professional.
Yeah.
Because they're the only one that can handle it.
I can think of so many movies right off the top of my head that do this. Yeah.
I'm just saying because we just talked about that.
Yeah.
That's literally a famous, he's exiled and trying to find peace. And they're like, you're the only one that can help us, John, you know?
Help us. So,
right. Obi-Wan Kenobi, right. Okay. Refusal of the call.
That's a great transition, by the way, because Star Wars has
refusal of the call.
So we have never brought this up in 115 episodes. So I thought this would... We'll finally talk about it a little bit. This movie has, in my opinion, a really instructive refusal of the call. Jamie, do you have like a stock description for this?
So the problem with refusal of the call with the stock description and me giving it is the Save the Cat debate hijacked it, right? So it really is the Save the Cat debate. So when I was first starting screenwriting, I was a hero's journey guy, and refusal of the call is the debate beat. Yeah. It's so basically something happens that, you know, calls to the hero, the catalyst, and then they refuse the call. They're like, I can't do that. For many reasons. And we've talked about in the past, I have a bunch of debate reasons that they might not be able to do it. They might be scared. They might be obligated to do something else. They might want more money or something. I don't know, whatever. There could be a million reasons why, and there's a lot of questions. So a hero typically, in a refusal to call, they're like, I'm not good enough. I can't go. Luke Skywalker, you know, I got to work at the farm. I can't do this. I can't go on an adventure. My uncle needs me. So they refuse
the call. A little bit more of the rings too, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. They're the best things to really get a true refusal of the call is those epic kind of stories, those golden fleece epic stories. So when Blake Snyder came around, like a couple years after I was already deep into the hero's journey, and that's what I was using as my go-to, he kind of substituted this word debate. And the debate was kind of a more broad, expanding version of refusal of the call, which made it much more accessible for me. Now, some people actually find it harder to understand than the refusal to call, but he kind of opened up the refusal to call to mean more things. And then as in the years since I've been teaching Save the Cat, I've even expanded it a little more. I've kind of opened it up. So refusal to call has gotten kind of, I don't know, hijacked in some ways into this section that really is some of it's refusal because of fear and stuff like that. Some of it is gathering of information the debate, at least. And so some of it is like, I don't really know what this is. Let me learn more about it. Let me see. Mm-hmm. Let me figure out what's going on. But at its heart in the hero's journey, it's like, no, I'm not doing that. I mean, that's really what it is at its heart.
Yeah, that is a great way to put it, as far as it just being, it's the same damn thing as the debate section. I hadn't really thought of that, but I wrote down some basic things that this one does that I think they pretty much all the good ones do. And the main reason I brought it up on this list is because I read a lot of scripts that either the refusal of the call isn't doing all these things I'm going to describe that they do in Aliens, or it's not there at all. Like, the call comes and they're like, let's do it. Like, you know what I mean? Like, it's just like completely flat and weightless. It's like a weightless beat in the story because it's easy.
Or they read that there needs to be a debate and they put like one line of debate in there, or literally, like, that's what I see a lot. Like, it becomes like half a page and they're like, I checked off my debate section.
Yeah. Moving
on. Should I do this? Okay, fine. Like, that's the whole
bit. Yes. Usually for me, it comes down to, in the script, it's a way too easy of a choice. That's what makes it a weightless, emotionally weightless moment. Because it's an easy choice. Like, hey, if you, go to this cool place with me, we're going to get $1 million. There's nothing bad's going to happen if you do it. And they're like, okay, sign me up. You know, like, give me that check. Let's go. Okay. So number one is, it establishes the overall stakes and rewards of the mission. So, like, this section is a great time to pause to the audience and really highlight, like, what are the stakes? What are the reward they could potentially gain for agreeing to go on this mission? And like you said, Jamie, there's fact-finding in that process that gets you these answers. And in this, there's like great examples, right? There's a colony of people to potentially save, potentially. Even though we all know they're dead, there's the small chance that we're talking about an entire colony of people that she could help them save. And then the stakes are... And another part is the potential. She even asked him, like, you're doing this to get rid of them, right? Like, the potential to help the company destroy the aliens once and for all. And then the second thing that it does well, that I think all refusals of the call does, is it establishes how our main character is feeling about all of this, because that's what I'm missing a lot. Like, I can't tell you how many times I read a script and I get halfway through and I've never been given the opportunity to hear them express how they're feeling about all this stuff, right? Like, it's like the most important thing. And so in this case, you know, she has the nightmares, and like, we get two sections of nightmare fuel. We get Ripley's main nightmare fuel, which is her fate worse than death for this story, which is impregnated by an alien.
She goes,
she just ups the chance that she's going to experience that fate worse than death. The second one is, her other nightmare fuel, which is that she's being deceived and used by the company to help them retrieve the aliens and bring them back to Earth, which is just what happened to her before. Like, history is repeating itself. I really hope that's not the case. And profits over people is going to happen in the future destruction of humanity. So all of those things are debated from her perspective in this little refusal of the call section. And then the last thing is, it establishes the feared obstacles, which is, she asks them, like, how many people are there? And then she discusses how many aliens there might be there. You know, we understand, and she understands, we're not just talking about one alien like before. We're potentially talking about hundreds of them, right? So the obstacles are right there. Yeah, the obstacles are right there for the audience to understand. So it's all put into place. And then all of this stuff makes accepting the call to action feel like a dilemma, right? That was kind of an amazing, appropriate.
Yeah, that was there. Yeah, that's probably intentional. Yeah,
but it makes the call to action, the accepting the call, a dilemma, right? She's damned if she takes the call. She's damned if she refuses it, because all these people could potentially die that she can help save. So, I think this is, if you want to know what a refusal of the call is, or as Jamie said, a good debate section is, I think watching this section around the time when they offer her the "we've got a job for you" and the scene, that scene and the scene after where she comes back to him and accepts the call, is a great example of how to do this right.
What's more important for writing a character too?
Yeah,
like, you know so much about Ripley just from this.
Yeah, or at least you get reminded, right, of all well, these let's, things. Let's,
this movie works without seeing Alien because of the scene.
Yeah.
Right? This gives you everything you need to know about Ripley without having watched Alien. Like, that's why Aliens works alone.
Yeah.
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 Because of the refusal of the call.
That's a good call.
Good. Yeah.
I refuse it.
No. The bait is a better coin term. I'll say
it
that.
Is. It's easier to understand what you're supposed to do there as a writer. Get them to debate it. Yeah.
Refusal of the call sounds like a 1930s book or something.
Yeah, but she refused it so hard.
No, she does.
Like, she's like, no, I'm not doing this. You know, like, I was like, this is a great refusal of the call.
No, it really is. And it gives you everything you need.
Yeah.
Do you want to talk about slow burn horror?
Yeah. So, you know, the way I term slow burn, it doesn't seem like Aliens. Like I said, the most intense movie I ever saw in my life in the theater doesn't sound like slow burn. And when I say intense, like Alien is a pretty intense watch in its own way, but it's a stress watch. It's a tension watch. It just gets to you with the dread and builds and builds and builds. I think this movie mimics it to that degree. I know the intention of this movie was not to mimic it at all. And it's funny because the feel of this movie does not mimic it at all. But similar to Alien, it holds back the monster to halfway through the movie. It doesn't give you even really a glimpse of the monster with the exception of that opening kind of chest burster scene just to say, hey, remember the first movie? This is the same thing. So just bear with us.
We'll get there.
we'll plant this bomb under the table.
Delivering the franchise expectations early.
Yes.
It's like, here we are. But it really takes to the midpoint of this movie. And this movie seems like a nonstop, action-packed, you know, just relentless kind of story. But it really is. It really ticks. And this is why I think it's so instructional in these terms. It really is slow burn horror in that it waits to the midpoint before it brings the beast. And it does something else. So what is it that this one does that makes it seem so fast paced, even though it's holding back the monster? And I think we talked about some of it. I think giving them a mission that's filled with mystery and stuff like that. And I think that's a big thing. So there are really three techniques I've been thinking about lately. One is kind of the Jason Blum thing where he said the drama needs to work without the monster. Okay. That's like task one. Like, can you write Get Out and make it so compelling that you could almost not do the horror movie and it would still kind of be interesting? It would still be kind of fun to watch. That's one. I don't think this movie does that. I think this movie's genre. You know, it does do a lot of good world building stuff though. There's a whole lot of little hints of world building and bigger world where they just throw out a line and it shows you how expansive the universe is and stuff like that.
Yeah. The off-screen movie is massive here.
The off-screen movie is massive. I mean, even what happened to the colonists and stuff like that, which wasn't an original cut. As I remember, there was a whole scene and they kind of showed you what happened, but they showed you life before the disaster sort of thing. So smart to just cut that out, you know, to just get rid of it, leave it as an off-screen thing. So the other thing that I've been talking about lately is I think changing the funny games. So there, I have two kind of terms for this, dread in games as opposed to fun and games.
Okay.
And then I say dread in games and more debate. Because that is really what happens in Jurassic Park, for example, or some of these other movies that hold it to the lots of dread, more debate, more questions, more mysteries to be solved, more things, more reasons to kind of not necessarily refuse the call, but to debate the call in some ways. Like, should we leave? Should we nuke it? What happened to these people? Is this a rescue mission? What is this? There's all kinds of things. I think part of what works for this movie, and I think this part's very instructive, if you can find a compelling goal, and I think this one has a hugely compelling goal for this dread and debate section, I think that does a lot of your heavy lifting. I think Alien worked the same way. Like, you know, when they went down to the planet to kind of see what this call was and things like that, it was a lot of mystery. It worked in the very much the same way as this one. But if you can come up with a very good goal to get us to the point where, in my opinion, all horror movies ultimately turn into survival stories at some point. It's just a question of, does it happen in the break into two? Like a movie like Don't Breathe or something like that, you know? Or does it wait to the midpoint like this movie? Or does it wait to, like, I don't know, some movies almost like the finale, like Megan or something like that, you know, where it becomes pure survival, where it's like just in the back end or something. But all movies ultimately horror movies turn into a survival story. And this one kind of happens in that middle section. But the only thing I thought we might look at for the dread part, and I know we've talked about dread a ton, but this one has so many dread flags, as I call them.
It does.
I'll introduce my dread flags topic. Let me just look up my list here. That I just thought we could just, I don't know, cherry pick.
Let's riff. Yeah.
Go for it.
So dread flags is something that when we were talking about the movie Barbarian, there was the origin story of my dread flags was that he was talking about how he took red flags about relationships or meeting somebody or got not really relationships, but almost like Tinder dates or something like that. Weird or meeting men, strange men or whatever. But he was reading a book about those and had these red flags. He basically wrote them into a story and they work like dread, which is dread. What I kind of have come to term in my mind is warning flags to the audience and or the characters. It's always the audience. The audience is the important part. But sometimes the characters pick up on these and sometimes they don't. And that's another big red flag.
You know, us being ahead of the characters who aren't picking up on them, right? Yeah.
So it's a bunch of little, like, hey, something bad's about to happen, warnings that keep coming at us. And I think in the better movies, they're almost relentless. It's like when we used to talk about the rooting resume and we found like in the Joker, there was like 20 instances in the first few minutes. I feel like dread flags do the same thing. Like you can almost watch the whole fun and games and like every 10 seconds you're getting a new one or they're milking the first one or something like that. So just super quick, here are some of my, I call danger zone flags. And just thinking about the fun and games section, the dread and games section, you know, if you can pluck some of these off. So off limits. So there's warnings not to go to a certain place. You know, these are kind of like, don't go past this sign. There's trouble.
Right.
I think this, just because of the nature of it, is off limits. Isolation. So some hint that like any kind of ability to call for help or anything like that is taken away. And I think just because of the distance with this one.
There's literally a video game called Alien Isolation.
Yeah. This one I see in almost every horror movie I watch, but I call it too far from shore or entering the kill zone. It's like when you get deeper and deeper into the kill zone. And this one, I think every inch of the journey is entering the kill zone. But whether we get to like the steamy dark area,
when they arrive to the complex, it's like, okay, well, there's no turning back, you know, like they're here and
naked and not afraid. I'm not sure that we have any of those, but sometimes people do strip off clothes, get in a shower or something like that, and make themselves even more dumb move. So sometimes they do something. And in this one, I tell you what the dumb move is when they take their bullets away, like that's the dumb move. You know, and we're like, oh, no, they're taking the bullets away. This is just dumb. And also then when they put them back, when they say there's nuclear reactors and stuff. It's like dumb move times two almost. Help is not on the way. You know, we get a glimpse of someone who might represent their savior, but they're asleep or something or incompetent.
Or we get multiple, even that, like they help the... The rescue evac thing is coming. Yes. But we know that it's invaded. And
yep. Right. Yeah. No, that's the one in this one for sure. All too peaceful. So this is when things are just too quiet. You know, there's no monster. It's just like
there's a lot of that in that whole section that. When they arrive and they're searching through for the colonizers. Yeah. There's just nothing
before they find the woman in the cocoon.
Yeah.
Like all that section. Yeah.
Similar. Too quiet is another one. It's just it's kind of related. They're kind of go hand in hand. And I think they're both there. Assault on the senses. So this could be smells, sounds, temperatures. It's kind of sweaty down there and stuff like that.
Hot, yeah.
Kind of hellish.
It's a dry heat, man.
It's a dry heat. Yeah. It looks like it stinks. Everything looks like it smells. Yeah.
Yeah. Gross and slimy. Yeah.
Yep. Howls in the dark. This is usually some noise off in the distance or some kind of screaming or howling or something like that.
You could almost translate that to the actual GPS.
Yeah, yeah. The tracker.
The tracker. Yeah. Yeah.
The tracker. Right. And that's constantly there.
It's constantly part of the movie, right? Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. 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 Yeah.
Infestations. These are usually like bugs.
Oh, man. Like everywhere.
That. Right. Yeah.
Things like that. Yeah. Things sprawling up. Markings or symbols. I'm not sure that. Was there any markings?
But I think you could do the same thing. Their version of it is like the melted acid marks. Right. You know? That's like the alien version or even symbols or ciphers.
Even all the bio organic material left behind by the aliens is that. Yeah. Right.
And there's structures that are
the structures they built.
Weird structures that's all over the place.
Yeah. I have another one that's kind of similar. Disturbing decor is the
disturbing
one.
Decor. Well, alien decor. There you go.
It's kind of like
H.R. Geiger's dream right there. Right?
Yeah, that's what their lair looks like. That's how they decorate.
That's it.
So to speak.
There you go.
Dark and stormy. So,
duh.
We got
wind,
that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Lack or excess of sunlight. It's lack in this case.
Yeah. And she said they mostly come at night, mostly.
Yep. Yeah. Signs of death is another one. So, usually this is blood, injuries, maggots. It could be anything like that.
The acid, again, that's probably where it fits better. There's just like holes of acid where.
Yep. Yeah.
They find cocooned people. I mean, is that
but even before that.
Even before that, right. Yeah.
Deserted and abandoned posts.
So they're everywhere.
Yeah, when they encounter places that should be inhabited. Yeah, but are abandoned. Eyes, I'm not sure if this one's probably there, but I just didn't track it. Eyes off the prize. So these are usually momentary distractions or their visions are blocked. Something happens where they're not looking in the right place. I'm not sure if there was one of these, but I bet there was.
I'd probably point to like when Burke, like something Burke did, like try to kill or try to infect Ripley and the girl. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Like they weren't expecting
survival. Yeah.
They weren't expecting Burke to become that.
Yeah.
And so they're looking the wrong way. The villain is the aliens, not Burke.
Yep. Yeah. When everybody in the control room is looking elsewhere and Burke turns off the camera. Yeah.
Good. Yeah.
And then we have the section I call evidence of evil, which some of these overlap, but there's ominous evidence. So some of this is we all know history repeats itself. Often past crimes go, you know, solved wrongly or stuff like that. So I honestly think this one is more Ripley's kind of, you know, history and things like that. Like she knows the history of
and we know her history.
And we know her history. Chekhov's chainsaws, because they don't use weapons, I'm not sure that this totally tracks, but this is usually when you see a weapon or something that you know is going to come back into play later.
I guess the facehugger eggs.
That's true. That's true.
That's you know their version of the chainsaw.
It really is. There. It really is. Yeah.
Were there blood?
Yeah,
kind of a little bit.
It's true. Yeah, I mean, that's kind of a weapon of sorts. That's something that's
a lot of people get burnt by acid blood. So,
sabotage, which is usually like slash tires, cut power lines, missing stuff.
Yeah, the Burke letting the
Burke. Yeah,
and then it's funny because then they have the
real villain. I mean, right? Yeah, Burke is the real villain. Yeah.
There's the whole thing too, where the aliens are smart enough to shut down the power. At some point, which is pretty awesome.
Raptors in the door handle, right?
Yeah.
They're here, which goes more to the supernatural. That's more like voices and apparitions and stuff. Where's Fido? So a lot of times when pets go missing, Left for Dead, when characters encounter injured, sick, or dead strangers. We see that.
There you go. The cocoon person. Yeah.
Cocoon, yeah.
This is the Robert McGee thing, but I call it hype the horror. Someone who has encountered the monster gives testimony about how deadly they are. And she does do that.
Praise the killer speech. Yeah.
She kind of has one of those where she's kind of calls them on their childish behavior at one point. Then there's cinematic moments. There's cat scares. There's just sudden kind of quick scares that come from, whatever. Killer POVs. I don't know that this one has a killer POV.
I don't think it does.
Yeah.
Alien 3 has a lot of them.
The body cams almost start to function.
Yeah, a little bit.
Like victim POV, where we're just getting this like close-up of monsters attacking them, dragging them, doing things to them.
After I watched this, I added found footage. I added that to my list.
That's good.
I do think that is one. I think that's the new one I picked up from this. I was like, yeah, found footage. So
even flipping, then.
Yeah. Flipping to security, body cams, anything like that, it just tells us something bad's going to happen.
Yeah.
I don't know why that's true exactly. I think it's because we can't control it, or we're disconnected. Yeah. We're seeing it as a third person.
In real life, those cameras are not usually there for good reasons ever.
Yeah.
Right.
They're there to see crime and problems and things.
Usually when we watch security cam footage, it's something bad.
It has to be for something bad.
Yeah. We're not watching
we're innately suspicious of it. Yeah.
CCTV shit is never good.
It's never. Yeah. It never is.
So you don't film a wedding with the CC camera, right?
Birthday parties.
Yeah, right.
So flickering light is another one.
Lots of that.
Yeah. Slow pace. Sometimes it's just stretching the camera shots and stuff like that. It's the stretching the edits. Provoking the monster. So summoning the beast is what this one. This is doing something that the character unknowingly will attract the monster's attention. Or mocking the beast. Characters who blatantly make fun of the monster, almost like bravado or something like that.
I don't know if anyone does that here specifically.
When she's giving the speech when they're on the way to the planet, and
before they get there,
and they're like, all I need to know is where they are. So I we got them anytime, anywhere. Right. We got them.
What happens is we karmically laugh at them. We're like, they're going to be screwed.
But it's a dread flag because you're like, these people are in charge of helping Ripley.
Yep.
She's with a bunch of clowns.
They don't respect
the monster. So,
Some of these are a little different than this because we don't have a lot of characters besides, but there's these are bad behaviors. Freaky friendly, which is sometimes characters are overly friendly. Silent and deadly, and that's the opposite end of the spectrum where people are like super quiet and standoffish. Bad temper, violent tendencies. So again, these are more, this would be for a different kind of movie. Creepy obsessions. I mean, maybe some of these could apply to I'm trying to remember the robot in this. It's
Bishop when he's Bishop.
Ash. It's Bishop. Unwanted conflict. Why is everyone acting so weird? And violations of privacy. So again, these are more for if you went to a haunted house and there was a character like the neighbor or something like that, creepy neighbor. And then there's suspense, like bomb under the table stuff. And I think that opening scene kind of provides a bomb under the table with just showing Ripley, showing what happens. And the previous movie's a bomb under the table as well. So
this entire movie.
It's bombs everywhere.
They're my list of dread flags. And
it's great.
As you can see, they're all over the place, and there's probably even more that I could add to my list.
It speaks to why the movie is so effective in creating dread. They're everywhere.
Yeah, they're everywhere. It's funny. The more I watch the best horror movies, they're just so loaded with dread. I mean, if you go, it's almost like if you could test yourself as a writer, and if you go a whole page and you can't even pick one of these out, you're probably doing something wrong in the debate, fun and game section, depending on your story. Something's gone wrong if you can't find one of these on almost every page of your first half of the movie. Once the second half starts, sometimes it devolves into a scare fest in an action movie. And sometimes you're trading dread for scares, but especially if you're in one of these slow burn, keep it from being a survival story to the middle. I think it's almost, I honestly, and I haven't tested this, but I bet you it's about one per page, or at least one every other page,
mm-hmm.
you know?
All right. Well, that's the dread flags. Good news, bad news technique. We've talked about this several times. I'm usually the one that tracks this, but Jimmy, you squeezed in a last minute one. You said
I did because it was so good, and I just was like, we got to do it. So, it was so good and so pure that I was like, I can write this down in like 30 seconds.
Right,
it's that easy to track. So, this technique, for anyone who's never heard of it, I believe it's a Ted Elliott and Terry Rossio who wrote Shrek and Pirates of the Caribbean and Aladdin and many other great movies.
Is it Bill Martell? It's probably all of them.
Bill, if I just misquoted, I'm pretty sure this is a WordPlayer article.
Okay. I'm Facebook friends with him, so.
Bill was a regular. Bill was a regular WordPlayer guy, so he'd know.
Oh, Bill did WordPlayer articles. Too?
He was just always on there. He was one of the guys.
Well, for anyone who's unfamiliar, they have a website that's like OG internet. It looks like it's from like 1997, and that's probably when they made it. And it has remained. They have fantastic articles on the craft. I highly recommend it. Bill Martell has all the blue books, which we also talk about on the show a lot. But it is, you got an action scene and you need it to be entertaining. You know how it's going to start. You know how it's going to end. But in the middle, your job is to make it as entertaining as possible. And a really simple way to do that is to just write on a blank sheet of paper a good news, a bad news, a good news, a bad news. And we've also talked about how in horror, sometimes it's bad news, worst news, worst news. And I did add a worst news in this, but this is mostly good news, bad news. So this is where they finally locate the colonizers. So right after that section we just talked about where they're searching for like 10 minutes.
Yeah, yeah.
And they've located, everybody has like a personal data transmitter on them that they've tracked the personal data transmitters to this location. And supposedly there's like going to be 300 people here to find. So here we go. This all happens in like 2 minutes, by the way.
Okay.
Good news. The team has tracked the PDTs to the location of the colonizers. Bad news. The area has turned into a giant, mysterious alien structure. The good news. There's no sign of these aliens who created this structure anywhere. The bad news. They find an alien facehugger egg. Oh, shit. The good news is the egg is empty. No facehugger inside. The bad news is they find one of the colonizers cocooned. The good news is the colonizer is alive. The bad news is the colonizer's impregnated with an alien and begs the soldiers to kill them. Worst news, the baby alien bursts out of the cocooned colonizer's chest. The good news is the team kills the baby alien with a flamethrower. The bad news is now they've awakened more aliens and there's aliens awake and attacking them from every angle. So there you go. That was 10 quick beats. And it just shows you how simple of a technique it is and how it makes the scene riveting, right? That's like one of those most riveting 2 minutes of the movie.
Good job.
Yeah, and by the way, I do think it's William Martell. I did a quick scan of Terry Rossio and a quick Google, and I know he had it in his book Action Scene Screenwriting Secrets or whatever that book was that he first wrote, the Blue Book.
Shame on me.
Yeah. So just FYI if you're looking for it. It very well could be in Ted and Terry's like buried in one of their articles, but just the titles didn't indicate it. So, I actually thought Bill Martell may have written an article for WordPlayer, and that's what I wanted to double
check. Your sleuthing found otherwise.
I didn't see it on my 10-second look, but it could be there. It could still be there.
Next time, do 15. Okay.
Yeah, I'll do 15 next.
You're right. Okay. Our next thing, I think it's funny that we kind of had a debate before we started recording about if horror movie versus action movie for aliens. And I feel like this whole time we're talking about horror stuff.
Yeah, we're totally
totally are doing all horror stuff. The next thing you want to talk about is horror character arcs. Whose is this?
Yes, this is mine.
This is Jamie. Mine. Okay.
So we talked once before about these Sam Raimi rules for
yeah.
writing or something. And now I should have looked them up because I'm only remembering the one I care about. But Sam Raimi had like three rules for writing. I'm going to look it up real quick.
Sam Raimi.
It'll take me 2 seconds, hopefully.
We're testing James.
I think I got it.
Okay. Do you have the three?
I have the three. Do you want me to read them?
Read them. Yep.
Okay. Number one is the innocent must suffer.
Yes.
Two, the guilty must be punished.
Yes.
Three, the hero must taste blood to be a man.
Yes.
And or a woman.
Right. Yes.
Right.
So, that's updated about like 40 years.
Yes. Yeah. That's from like probably the early 70s.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's the last one I really want to talk about, even though the first two you can almost see.
Totally.
In this as well. And I think a lot of times the guilty must be punished, or people like Burke, you know, Burke must die. Or in King Kong, like, I can't remember the guy's name, but the guy brought him over and did all the stuff. And he basically asked to die at some point, even though I don't think he does he? I can't remember.
I don't think so.
Does he still live in the end? But I picked the one thing about.
That's the
for some reason I have this picture, because here's the sad thing about King Kong that I was thinking of is my definitive King Kong version, because it was another one I saw, was the 70s version.
Right.
I saw as a little kid, and that movie had a huge impact on me. Not quite as big as Aliens, but pretty big. It's amazing how big of an impact that movie had on me. But anyway, so I'll skip.
We
that
haven't done
example.
A King Kong movie.
No,
that's crazy. Yeah,
let's do the 70s one. No, so
whatever you want, Jamie.
Yeah,
doing.
Exactly.
Let's do all three. Let's
So what I think in a lot of horror character arcs, you have characters that have, for lack of a better term, we'll use the modern term, a lot of trauma in some ways. Some of them with grief. Some of them have been through a horrible thing.
Mm-hmm.
Almost across the board, whether it's The Descent, Midsommar, you know, the Evil Dead reboot, you know, any of these kind of movies, there's somebody that has this kind of thing they need healed. Aliens, right? And while Aliens is a little different in some ways, I think it's the, you have to, I think Alien does this to an extent too. I think a lot of horror arcs, they don't give you the learning lessons that other stories would kind of give you. They don't check the boxes of like, you know, and I'm going to take this back a little bit. I'm going to say, if you assume her arc is the director's cut version more than the real version or whatever the
theatrical
version. So the director's cut version has this backstory element that she came back and she was 57 years old, and basically her daughter had lived her life, or I'm sorry, her daughter was 57 years old. It's 57 years later or whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
So the daughter might've been, I don't know how old the daughter was, 60, 70, whatever. But the daughter had lived her life, got cancer, I think, and died or something like that. And now, so there's grief. There's this grief thing on top of the whole PTSD aspect. There's also this, you know, I missed my entire life with my daughter. I promised her I'd be back for her birthday. I promised all this stuff. I never got that. So that's kind of at the center of her shard of glass, or whatever you want to say, her problem that needs to be fixed. And in horror, instead of like ticking off the boxes of learning, even though this movie does a little bit better because she has Newt and she can protect Newt, where she was never with her own daughter, but at least she can save this life and kind of be a mother for that she wasn't to her own daughter. This does have at least a little bit of that, but it doesn't have the little learning lessons that would teach you. Instead, it puts them in the worst possible gauntlet that you could imagine, the ultimate classroom, which is a battle for survival, where you have to kind of find your inner strength. You have to find this thing that you didn't even know was in you. Now, of course, this is a sequel. So she kind of had it in her before. She kind of found it already. But it has to reemerge because, you know, she's the person
that has to
that
go even harder. She has to find more of what she had, right?
She refused the call, remember? She wasn't like, I'm going to go back and kick some aliens' butt. She was like, we don't want any part of those things. Let's just stay away. I'm scared. I'm, you know, let's not do it. And then she goes, and she goes into full warrior mode. And I think a lot of horror movies function off of this. This is how their character arcs are built. They don't necessarily get taught the same lesson that another character would get taught. They get taught to find their inner resolve, their inner strength through tasting blood. That's what they do. So they taste the blood. They see the death. They see how horrible and tenuous the world is. They become this warrior and they fight to live another day. And they realize that when they win that battle for the rest of their life, they'll know kind of how sweet life is or how quick it could be taken away. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of horror movies and this one function off of that model. So
if you watch Alien 3, it's
cool. Yeah. Yeah.
I do think it would be great to do that next April.
Yeah. Yeah. Sorry. Yeah. I mean, just thinking about where it goes, it's where hard it not goes. To say it. Yeah. Like, she learns the lesson pretty quick.
It gets so much worse.
I think it would be interesting to edit these two movies into one, like, 90-minute movie. Because it'd be the sudden shift where it's like, oh, and then she died. And then, you know, and all this crazy stuff kind of happens in three at the midpoint. Anyway, so that's basically, anyway, that's what I wanted to
I like
mention.
It.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I like it.
And again, I'm not sure. Like, there is part of me that wonders if the daughter thing actually helps the story. I actually think this is one of the cases where I do think it helps a little bit. It is kind of intriguing to hear that part of it.
It kind of gives, like, Newt this finished
thing. Yeah, it adds more weight to the Newt relationship.
I don't think it hurts to take it out, which is interesting.
It's still a great movie regardless.
But I do kind of like the addition the addition of it. Where I don't like the, like I said, like the parts that they originally had.
Seeing the colonizers and all of that stuff. Yeah, agreed.
Like, great edit there. And I know this edit was more for time. I think they just recognized, you know, we can cut that out and it's still, she already has PTSD, shard of glass, trauma, you know, all that stuff. We don't need to add one
there's
more.
Also, it's not just a mother-daughter thing. There's also a bit of her saving herself.
Right.
Right? She saves Newt, she saves herself, you know.
Yeah.
She doesn't want Newt to have the faith that she had, all that kind of stuff.
Right.
It tracks in different ways.
Exactly. Newt is the best case future self if she can get her out of there.
Right, right. Yeah.
I've never really analyzed sequels in this way because I've never personally, I'm trying to remember, I don't think I've ever had to write a sequel or anything like that in my life or been assigned.
I actually have.
You have? Yeah.
It was a fucking challenge.
Like
the worst parts of the script are like retreading and hoping that the people don't have to revisit the first one in order to understand.
Yeah, make it self-sufficient, right?
Yeah.
Because, you know, how do you approach character arcs in the sequel? Because usually they have an arc, you know, she tasted blood in the first movie and became a warrior, you know? Does she need to do it again?
I think the best, like, franchises approach, if you can do this, approach it like you actually look at the movies as acts.
Right.
Of another movie, you know, like you can't always do that because of how movies are made.
It's like old wounds, but new wounds.
New wounds and everything. I think Aliens is a great second act for that character. Mm-hmm. You know, I'd argue Aliens 3 is even a great third act, but that's a whole different argument. And it's a much more debated one.
Woo!
Yeah. But yeah. Like I think that's what makes a great franchise is if they can actually stand back and look at it like a giant story.
Their own things. Yep.
Mm-hmm.
That big pieces of the character puzzle.
But it was studio filmmaking. That's like impossible. Right. Do you have anything else on that, Jamie? Was that it?
No, that's it. Okay. That's it.
This Make It Harder is a really funny segment title. Make It Harder. Whose is this?
Make it more difficult. Yeah, harder is sexually connotated. So the only time that I have ever talked about this was the Mission Impossible Six? Is that what part six? Mission Impossible. Sky,
it's Fallout.
Fallout. We did that. Yes. Yeah. Yes. Well, see, so if you haven't listened to that and then you haven't heard me spout about this.
Right.
So the first I'm going to set it up and then I'll use alien examples. So like one of the most common problems with scripts I'm reading is the lack of formidable obstacles from fade in to fade out. Like it's almost always from scene to scene, way too easy for the characters I'm reading to achieve the little mini goals as they go along and ultimately to achieve the overall goal. So like this even comes with like, the scripts can have everything else going for it, right? They got great characterization. They got great clear goals. They got clear rewards, clear stakes. But here we go and we get into the scenes and everything's just way too easy. Like, and so it makes it an emotionally weightless experience because if we deem everything happening way too easy, then it doesn't feel like the victory is well earned, right? And so I think
bring it back to what we just read with Sam Raimi, the innocent must suffer.
Level of suffering, man, I'm writing that down. Suffering, make them suffer is better than make it harder. them suffer.
Mother Teresa believed in suffering, so
wow,
there you go.
That's a hell of a parallel.
I'm not joking, it's a real thing.
Okay, so I'm going to use an example. So I read a script once and it was a treasure hunt story. I don't know if you've ever read any treasure hunt stories like this, Jamie, but chime in where you can. All right. So the main character found the map and the map was in perfect condition. They built a team to go get this treasure and everybody in the team gets along great. They get a ship and, the ship is in great condition. It's everything they need to get to where they need to go. They travel across the ocean. It's sunny. There's no problems. They get there. They get to the island and they follow the map, which is easily readable. And the treasure's right where the map says it was going to be. And when they get there, there's nobody guarding the treasure. So they pick it up and they put it in the boat and they go home.
That's not a story. That's a vacation.
Dude, this encapsulates so many scripts that I read from new writers, which is just like they think, well, I have all this interesting stuff happening. It's checking the genre boxes, right? It's doing all these things that people want from a treasure hunt story, except everything was way too easy. There's literally no obstacles. They think the acquisition of these things and this progress is the obstacle, right? Making progress is the obstacle, but they don't understand that, no, you need actual obstacles that come in every way, shape, and form at every moment of this plot. So the treasure map needs to be withered. You can barely read it. I don't even know if we're going in the right direction. I don't even know if we're going to the right island. The crew needs to be in constant conflict with each other, right? The ship needs to spring leaks. Oh, shit, the sail tore.
Have a storm.
There needs to be storms in the open sea. You need another crew with another ship racing you to get to that same island with their own copy of the map. You need, when they get to the island, the treasure isn't where the map says it's going to be. Oh, shit, what are we going to do now? They find the treasure finally on the island, and when it's there, oh shit, they gotta get through traps, and there's weird guards, and there's all this stuff in the way to get to the treasure. And when they get to the treasure, the other team is there too, and they gotta fight the other team to get to the treasure. So it's all about piling on nonstop, never-ending, formidable obstacles. And when you do that, and the hero still overcomes them, that's when the journey feels so resonating, right? That's when it feels so riveting. That's what makes you go like, holy shit, this is so much fun. So I started late into the story, but I figured I just like go down a list. It's sort of almost like a high level good news, bad news. Like I almost feel like there's an exercise to be done with good news, bad news as a beat sheet. Like at the higher level, because all I'm going to describe for you is beats. And it's like, it's going to feel like I'm describing like a scene, but I'm just describing beats. This is how many. So I started at 43 minutes. All right, here we go. So this is how This is how Aliens makes Ripley suffer. Makes them suffer. I'm using that term now, Bob. I'm changing my codification. Well,
don't thank
forever.
Me. Thanks, Sam Raimi.
Okay. They discover while they're going through looking for the colonizers, they discover tanks filled with facehuggers. So there's not just one facehugger to worry about. As they feared, there's tons of facehuggers everywhere. While searching the alien cocoon structure, Ripley realizes, oh shit, they can't use bullets or risk thermonuclear explosion. So now they have to search for the missing people and travel through these alien structures without any bullets to fight with, making them suffer, making it harder. They escape the alien invaded complex in their rover, but the axle's broken and now the vehicle's inoperable. So what are they going to do now? They call for help from the space orbit, and help is on the way, but the flying evac vehicle has been invaded too, and the vehicle crashes, so they're fucked again. And by the way, that's when it says, what are we gonna do now? It's game over, man.
Right.
I feel like you should always be having your character have to say that. What are we gonna do now? It's game over.
Right.
Newt says, oh, by the way, we need to get back into a safe area because it's about to be dark, and that's when they come, mostly at night. They find somewhere to hide finally, and they make a plan in the complex, and Ripley asks how long before rescue will come from the military, and Hicks says 17 days. And
17 last days. 17 yeah. hours. Yeah.
So, fuck. Even though they feel safe for the moment, it's going to be 17 days before help is on the way. Based on Bishop's findings, they assume there's over 100 aliens. And oh, by the way, they just realize as they're discussing this and talking this out that all those aliens come from eggs. And there must be somewhere here that they haven't crossed paths with this giant alien queen that they're going to have to get through in order to escape this situation.
Right.
And by the way, they can't just sit tight and wait for rescue. There's a leak somewhere nearby, and the entire complex is going to explode soon with the strength of 40 megatons and a blast radius of 30 kilometers. So they can't just sit tight. They got to get the fuck out of here now. While Ripley and Newt are sleeping, Burke lets facehuggers out of their tubes. And also, by the way, he turns off the cameras so the team can't see that Ripley and Newt are in trouble. The aliens cut the power. The team's alien barricade plan didn't work because the aliens found a way to attack them from above. On their way to escaping the complex, Newt falls down a shaft and the aliens kidnap her. Ripley, even though she manages to find Newt, she's in front of the alien queen and her guards. She finally finds a way to rescue Newt, and she goes back to get to the ship, but the ship is gone. They get back to the rendezvous point, and the ship is gone. The queen, by the way, rode the elevator up to the top, and now she's after Ripley and Newt again. The ship comes back, but by the way, the queen rode with them. Ripley fights the queen in the loader, knocks her into the vent shaft, but when she tries to open the vent and flush her out into space, the queen grabs her ankle and makes her suffer. Yeah. So, I mean, this movie just one after another stacks on these obstacles, makes them suffer. It just feels like every single time they get some good news, there's something bad that happens on top of it for the duration of the story. And I think that speaks to why it's such like a riveting watch. So yes, you need to make your characters suffer as often as possible. We even got a question about that I think we talked about one of these episodes where a listener was like, why do I have to make my characters suffer?
Well, you I want like your... my characters. Yeah. Like...
yeah.
Yeah. But nobody else is going to, if you don't make them suffer.
Right.
You gotta
perfect, perfectly put. Nobody else is going to.
It's also goes back to the Sam Raimi thing. So in Save the Cat, there's this idea that story is a transformation machine, that the real heart of story is transforming a character from one thing to another.
Right.
The suffering is what transforms them.
You don't change from everything being nice.
You don't. You don't. You don't. Even when you get the positive lessons, you don't pay attention to them. Unless you're kind of suffering and looking and grasping for a lifeline. So it's really important to make them suffer. One other thing I wanted to add, because you were talking about how the good news, bad news could be a beat sheet thing. You know who does that? Dove Simmons does that. He does Dove Simmons beat sheet. And I don't have it internalized, so I can't say it exactly. But his thing is, every story has five uh-ohs, oh shits, and oh my gods. And that's how he tracks it. And it's actually his structure is like, okay, do this five times. First, there's an uh-oh, then there's an oh shit, then there's one oh my god, and then they resolve it. And then you give him another uh-oh, oh shit, oh my god. And you do that five times and you have a movie. That's kind of his thing.
I'm laughing because I took Dove Simmons' course about 20 years ago, and he's such a character. Bob, you ever heard him talk?
I have not.
He talks like he belongs in a Seinfeld episode. He's like, he talks like this.
Yeah.
He's like, what do you want? He's got a catchphrase. He says, what do you want? Like, he says that after everything. What do you want?
He was the guy that...
No, I imagine him saying, oh, shit.
Yeah. So, and who Dove Simmons is, like, especially in the 90s, he got popular. He was kind of the guy, like, make your own movie. You know, he was teaching you how to make a movie.
His name is
made
Dove?
Him famous.
Dove. D-O-V. Yeah.
Tarantino made him famous because Tarantino said the only film school I ever went was to Dove Simmons' course.
Right.
And that so
it was like a weekend kind of thing, right?
Yeah. And so of course I went to it in the 90s. Yep.
Sounds like quite a character, that guy. He's probably had a lot of suffering to turn him into such an interesting guy.
I know. He claims that Jurassic Park was a $14 million movie.
What? Okay.
He goes this whole thing. He's like, this set $112,000.
Sounds like a character.
Like, which movie are you going to see? The $14 million budget movie or the $200 million budget movie? It's like, it's bullshit.
He's arguing it costs less. Okay.
Yes.
All right. I've never heard that. Not so secret weapon.
Is this still Jimmy? I've said this many times, but we'll go again. Because this is one of the best ones.
We use this one as the example usually.
This is one of the main examples for this technique. So this is a specialized person placer thing that you set up that later the hero is going to use in the finale to win the day. And I even think if we start studying it through the Save the Cat lens, it would be like, remove the shard and use the not so secret weapon, like, you know, because Luke removes his shard and uses the Force to blow up the Death Star. It's crossing the streams in Ghostbusters. It's the oxygen tank in Jaws. It's Cecilia in it using the invisibility suit in Invisible Man. It's Dutch's mud camouflage in Predator. It's the dead and buried Altverse Doctor Strange in Multiverse.
Hell yeah. Or,
yeah. It's Sam Raimi. It's singing Christmas carols in Elf to save Christmas. The best way to spread Christmas cheer is to sing loud for all to hear. So in this case, it's not just a Chekhov's gun, like Bob brings up a lot. It's the Chekhov's gun.
Yeah, right.
And if you can disguise it, even better. And so this one is, of course, the alien loader. I actually tracked all the beats to this, and it's kind of amazing how little it's in the movie. I don't know if you guys remember, but so 14 minutes in, there's the first beat is a little bit of foreshadowing, and I love it because they bury that it's a setup by mocking it. Ripley, like, Burke's there trying to convince her to join them on their mission, and she's like, I can't talk about this, I have to go to work. And he's like, oh, right, I heard you're working the cargo docks, running loaders and forklifts. I think it's great you're keeping busy, right? He's like, you know how to work a loader? How great.
A woman? You? Furthering the theme of not listening or trusting women in the franchise, right?
Ugh. And then the second beat is, so about a little bit over 10 minutes later, 27 minutes, we get our first visual, and it's not Ripley using the loader, it's somebody else using the loader, but we see that it's carrying like a massive cargo load, so this thing is huge. And then Ripley, right away after that, says, hey, she's like how can I be of any use to the Marines? And she's like, is there anything I can do? And they're like, oh, I don't know. Is there anything you can do? And she's like, well, I can drive a loader. I have a class 2 rating. So we get this little sense of like that she has like some official recognition here. And then we get
she's a pro, and then we get a full
scene where not only do we see that she's a pro, the Marines watching her are like really impressed. They're like, yeah, she's awesome.
Yeah.
But then it isn't, we never see a loader or hear about a loader until 2 hours and 9 minutes. So that was 28 minutes. So we almost go 2 hours without it, but it still works. And I think it's instructive that they just gave us that one big highlighted scene, just Ripley and the loader, that I think cements it in our minds and makes it so cool and interesting and memorable that even though we're not really thinking about it, when we get there, we're like, oh, fuck. That's right. She's a professional loader operator. So anyway, yeah, this is like my favorite not so secret weapon. I don't know about you guys, but
I think also you could attribute some of the other stuff she does in the movie, like the fact that she is, it's something we don't get in Alien, is this is kind of a new thing, right? Like she can operate this machinery. She's really good with learning machines, how they operate with her hands. She kind of does with the guns. She gets
it's
very
a nice
quickly
setup for her learning the guns, and we have a repetition of her wanting to educate herself really quickly.
One of the great like suit up, you know, montages in cinema history, and she like knows the fucking flamethrower and the guns and how to put them all together, how they operate, how the grenades the loader stuff prepares you for how well she is capable in that end. For all the other stuff,
it lays the groundwork in your mind that
this is extremely capable, you know, person, has the mind of an engineer, as the mind of a, you know, a blue collar worker. She knows exactly what she's dealing with. You know, she would know how to unlock the airlock and everything, like, you know what I mean? Like,
it feels authentic.
Yeah, it feels, it makes it all that stuff feel more authentic.
It doesn't feel like
it's not just the loader.
You buy it all.
Yeah. The not so secret weapon is her ability almost half.
Yes.
You know? Yeah.
You're right. The execution of that makes all that stuff easy to swallow. Yeah. Yeah.
She's a fast learner. She knows
a lesser version. All of a sudden would be a person you never knew, you never saw was capable of this, picking up all the guns and blowing up alien queen.
I mean, even just operating the load at the beginning, she has incredible like execution over her faculties and her motor skills and everything. It makes you believe that she could survive this hellish fucking,
on top of everything we just
19 minutes of hell, right?
Yeah.
Because it's 19 minutes, right? Like until they're going to explode.
Like
to survive that, she has to be like an extremely capable warrior, you know, construction worker, loader, whatever you want to say. She is completely capable of doing so.
Bob, and you brought up something that's not on the talking points, that to them not listening to her.
Yeah, yeah.
One of the things that struck me this time watching it was how much tension there is in. It's this interesting thing where she's not an active protagonist, but we know she's capable of being one, and everyone around her is in a role that keeps her from being passed, from being active and participating. And there's like tension, just like give her the keys, you know, just like pass her the leadership baton and everything will be so much better. And the fact that no one around her is willing to do that, there's all this tension, right? Built
up. She argues at one point that Hicks has the comm, but then they argue him away from it. But she wants him to have it because he listens to her.
Yeah,
he's the only character actually listening. Yeah, he respects her and listens
to her. It's that lack of respect for her experience. Yeah. There's so much tension there. It's almost at the level, Jamie, of the Dread Flag of disrespecting the monster. Like, he's disrespecting
the half man.
Yeah.
Like, so, why wouldn't you listen to Ripley?
Yeah, like,
she's just, you know that she has encountered these things and was floating in space for 57 years. You know what I mean? Like, her whole life was destroyed by these things. You think she's, like, bullshitting?
Yeah,
like talking about these things. No,
there's a reason she's included. Yeah, in the mission. Right. But that moment where she takes the wheel from the person in charge who's like can't handle the situation anymore, and she just starts driving the vehicle toward the danger. like it takes an hour to get there, but when it gets there, it's like so satisfying. It's like finally she's
in control,
refusing to be disrespected anymore, and she's taking control of the situation.
Also, once
and
again,
it's
her
so
operating
satisfying
her operating future machinery that yeah. she's never operated before.
Yeah.
With you know, and she knows what she's doing and can handle it. I mean, yeah. I'm saying the loader really sets that up.
It really does.
Yeah,
I think I remember something about the loader too, that it was in a different project of James Cameron's, and he took it from that and put it in this.
Oh, nice. Smart.
He had some kind of script, or I don't know if it was a project or
maybe it was Avatar, because Avatar was written in the 90s,
No, well, this was written in the 80s.
So,
and this was, it was probably, you know, during his Roger Corman days or something. And I think he had a story about somebody battling an alien with kind of a power loader or something, some version of it. And it was just that, like, that was the whole story kind of thing. And I think he took that and said, I'm going to steal that for aliens.
Oh, it's so good.
I mean, that's what writing is, right?
Yeah.
I had this idea years ago.
Yeah, it's on the whiteboard for this other thing.
I'm never doing that. So let's just put it in here. Right.
Well, and you think about James Cameron, it's kind of like now, like so much of our pop culture is based on his work in some ways, or things he introduced. But that was the first time I saw Space Marines, like, and they just became a trope almost, you know, mm-hmm. Space Marines, like, you know, Warhammer then exploded with
Starship
like
Troopers.
And Starship Troopers, the book was around before that. So I'm sure he got the idea from that, but it was the first time we kind of saw him in like mainstream movies. It was like, oh, you can have Space Marines.
And it makes it grounded because they're not using lasers.
Yeah. Yes. Yes.
Yeah. Using bullets is
But even things like the power loader, like mechs in general, you know, that's kind of different. And then you get to like the T-2000 or something. You just had so many cool ideas that almost get taken for granted of now, so many years later.
Did he have was his three run Terminator, Aliens, Terminator 2? Was that back to back to back?
Pretty sure. I'll check.
I'm pretty sure.
It's because you think it's like 84, 86, and like 92.
He did Funny Farm in the middle.
He did Funny Farm.
Let's not go disparage Funny Farm now.
I think he did Funny
Farm. I won't stand for it.
We don't need to look it up. I was just curious.
I'm looking it up.
I was like, man.
He did the Yahoo Sirius sequel.
Right. Piranha 2, Terminator, Aliens, The Abyss.
The Abyss, of course.
Still, you throw that in there. I mean, it's on the man.
You know, when you just boil it down to the movies he's made, not all the other stuff, he's made so few movies. And that's not it's fine. I'm not like insulting that, but like you think James Cameron's list would be like three times longer, and it's just not.
Yeah.
It's the difference between him and Ridley Scott. If you go for the guy who directed Alien versus the guy who directed Aliens, Ridley Scott has had quantity with the occasional masterpiece. Whereas,
can't win them all.
Yeah, sure. I'm not.
Of course, when it takes you 20 years to make Avatar 2.
Yeah.
Right.
Which I still haven't seen.
God. I liked it.
Good.
So there's my review of Avatar.
We almost did it on the show.
Almost. Yeah, almost. We have one more topic.
Yeah, it's a quick one.
Jimmy, repetition. We've talked about this a few times.
So this is.
Yeah.
I just wanted to show how this
movie. Keep repeating
used.
This one.
Keep repeating
the over same and over. Things. Yeah.
Why does anyone listen? Oh my God. So this is a. I just wanted. There's a really simple instructive one, and I love that it's only a rule of two. I thought that was. Nice to see that when it's really good, you don't even need three. Using repetition is a way for it creates a pattern. And when the audience sees the same scenario or hears the same dialogue, it creates an opportunity to reverse it. And usually when in a really easy way to communicate to the audience that a character is growing and changing or that a relationship is growing and changing is to repeat something that we recognize and connect with those people. And you just as showing how the situation is changing, even though it's the same scenario, you can show how the character is either progressing or regressing, or how the relationship is progressing and regressing. And so this is a great example of a scenario repetition, and maybe there's only two of them because we meet, we, it's like an hour before we meet Newt. So I think it's like 47 minutes, but yeah, anyway, it's Ripley putting Newt to bed.
Yeah.
So we get two nice repetition of that. When they're in the med lab, which actually doesn't go well, Ripley says, now you just lie here and you have a nap. You're exhausted. Newt says, I don't want to. I have scary dreams. And they just talk about their nightmares for a second. And then Ripley finally says, just go to sleep and don't dream. And then in the end, after they've escaped all the horror together and bonded and everything's now, this is really in the denouement. This is after the climax. And they're getting into hypersleep. Newt says, she's putting Newt to bed again. And Newt says, are we going to sleep all the way back? And Ripley says, that's right. And Newt says, can we dream? And she, Ripley says, yes, honey, I think we both can. And this holds even more meaning because we've seen that Ripley's been haunted by nightmares when she first awoke. And so she's saying she's not afraid to have sleep anymore because she overcame all that stuff. So this is a great example of taking the same scenario and using it to show how things are growing and changing. So that's all.
Well done.
I felt like it would. We got it.
No.
That's it.
It's a beautiful moment in the movie.
And then the repetition of stay away from her, you bitch.
You know, something I learned doing a little bit of research for this episode was I didn't actually know that was the Newt's, that actress. That's her only credit. She didn't. Yeah.
Whoa.
She's a school teacher now. She never did another movie. That's her only credit. What a credit. I didn't know that.
I'm surprised because over the years, there's been like little articles about her, like, you know, or one time, and now you wouldn't believe what she looks like now or whatever.
Oh my gosh.
There's a lot of those I see over the years with Newt.
Carrie Henn. Yeah, it's just, well, no, she has other stuff, but I saw an interview with all of them where she was like, she pretty much quit acting after that. So,
but she goes to like Creature Feature Weekend 24 days.
Yeah,
a year,
yeah.
24 times a year.
Hey, get that money. Get that money. Sign those.
Jamie, that feels like a good segue for.
Yeah, do you want to plug anything, Jamie?
That's right. I'll be at Creature Feature Weekend with Newt, and we'll be signing. Loaders or something. I don't know. What would be the little goofy, corny thing you'd bring from this movie? What would be the, I guess, because it's sci-fi, it doesn't have like the pea soup.
Well,
can
I already did it. I brought my VHS to Lance Henriksen.
There you go.
I have a signed Aliens VHS.
Yeah, VHS is fine, but I want something better. I want something cooler. Face hugger. Give me something. But anyway,
maybe Burke's, little car.
Yeah, I want a full size stand up of Paul Reiser, not from this movie, just of Paul Reiser, and I want it to be signed by the whole cast. But
a Comedy Store glossy.
Paul Reiser.
His suit jacket that they just flipped up.
Him from like Mad About You season 3. You know, like that's what I want. Yes.
But Jamie, I stepped on your plug.
Oh, it's really not. I mean, who knows if people will hear this before then? I know this isn't like a week-to-week type podcast for many. Many people find this decades later, and they'd be like, damn it, 20 years ago, I could have seen Jamie Nash at Creature Feature Weekend on April 20th in Gettysburg, Maryland, PA. Gettysburg, PA. But that's where I'll be, April 20th. At Creature Feature Weekend in Gettysburg.
Yeah, I'll never forget when a friend listened to the Home Alone episode from like 2018, and they were like, "Dude, you sound so sick. Are you okay?" And I was like, "That was
before COVID. That was so long
ago.
That
was like 6 years ago.
I was 12 years old.
We were doing this in person."
Yeah, no, I always, if anyone like from the show,
we used to cough in each other's faces.
Some people will message me sometimes from like fans of the show and like ask me about something I said 5 years ago. And I'm like, I don't remember what I said last week or yesterday.
I couldn't even remember if we had done Aliens before. Yeah. I was like, Aliens? Didn't we do that?
We did Alien. Yeah. We have done, yeah, for anyone listening, if you didn't get that from the episode, we've done Alien. So we've also done T2, if you're interested in James Cameron. I don't think we've done any more Cameron, though.
Mm-mm.
So we've done.
Someday
we've done
we'll T2. Do Titanic or we'll do
Funny Farm.
I can't we'll watch Funny Titanic, Farm. So no. Remember, I vowed not to watch it in forever. So.
Sorry.
Yeah.
It's off the table.
I'm sorry, guys. I mean, I vowed. I took a vow never to watch it.
Why did you take a vow to
comedy
never watch?
Because people were shocked that I had never seen Titanic. And all my friends were like, how have you not ever seen Titanic? And I was like, you know what? I'm never watching it. Now, because you all think it's weird that I haven't. So now I just, for comedy reasons, I'll never see Titanic.
It does a lot of the same things. It breaks the dread.
I'm sure it's fine. Yeah. I'm sure it's fine. I've got nothing against it. I just, now it's for comedy. I got to
complete the joke. The not-so-secret weapon is the door she floats on. We see that door like 10 minutes into her being on the Titanic. Like, she's going to use that.
You know what would have been a better Titanic? If she floated on the painting he made of her. Like, that was the better.
Oh, shit.
That would have been a better Nazi.
I know all about the door.
And it would have been smaller. You know,
James Cameron's like responded to the door criticism.
Yeah, he had an MIT study done to prove that she could float on the door. He did.
Well, anyway, Jimmy, see Avatar 2. Jamie, I'm not recommending it to you.
I saw it.
Okay.
It was, I don't know.
There you go.
I mean, I think it's a fine movie. I just didn't have much interest in it for some reason. Yeah.
I get more than the first one.
I'm going to say one more time. If you have questions about this episode, about an episode we recorded in 2018 when we were sick and in person, write us at writersblockbusterspodcast@gmail.com. We're building a big long list of questions to answer. We might even do just an answering questions episode in the future. So please.
And Jamie's excited about that. I know that.
Yeah.
I can't wait to do that one. That's
yeah,
the one
all questions episode. Yeah.
Yes.
All
right. So we need questions. Help
us. We need
us
questions.
Out.
We
Come
need
on.
Good. We need good questions.
Good questions. I don't need.
Or
good
you
questions.
Can ask like, what's our favorite pizza? I don't know.
No, I would actually love if people were like, "What is your guys' top five? You know, baseball movies or something? Like, you know what I mean? Like, ask us shit like that. I would love to do that. That'd be great.
Yeah. What microphone is Jimmy using? He sounds sick.
We've already gotten emails about that.
Not an expensive
one. Jimmy sounds like shit.
Why does Jimmy sound like shit?
We have gotten emails like that.
Right. Yeah. So, yeah, ask us, I guess, anything. Just make it, you know, make it PG, please. You know,
yes.
We don't need any gross stuff.
But writersblockbusterspodcast@gmail.com.
Right. All right. I think that's everything. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Thanks for listening, everyone.
Bye.
Hey, this is Bob Rose, and thank you for listening to Writer's Blockbusters. If you'd like to financially support the show, please consider joining my Patreon. I've been producing the podcast for several years completely out of pocket, and I'd like to keep producing it ad-free and no longer at a loss. If you'd like to help, head on over to patreon.com/BobRoseSucks. That's right, Bob Rose sucks. And if you want the one and only Jimmy George to help polish up that writing project you're kind of struggling with, head on over to scriptbutcher.com. As a listener, you already know he's the best there is, scriptbutcher.com. You can also support the show by simply sharing it or leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. We appreciate both. Thank you for listening, and see you next episode.